So welcome to the show. My name is Dan Lukasik, the creator of Lawyers with Depression. Today's guest is Jordana Confino, my good friend. And Jordana is a certified professional coach, speaker, and advisor valued for her expertise in positive psychology and well-being. 7 years after graduating from Yale Law School, she founded JC Coaching and Consulting to empower lawyers and other high-achieving professionals to transform their lives and work for the better. Jordana is an adjunct professor at Fordham Law School, where she teaches a course on positive lawyering, which educates law students and how they can harness the insights and science-backed strategies of positive psychology to reach their highest potential and build meaningful, satisfying careers in the law. So, welcome, Jordana, and thanks so much for taking the time to do this interview today.
Thank you so much, Dan. I'm delighted to be with you this afternoon.
Yeah, so we know each other quite a bit, and we're in the We have this interest in well-being and wellness and mental health and the law. And you've written extensively and have a very impressive website and blog on the topic. Let's focus our attention today on this topic of perfectionism in the law.
Yeah.
Why are you so interested in this topic?
Oh gosh, you can call it a personal passion project, as I feel like a lot of people that are doing work in this area, which I know you appreciate, it stems from our own experiences. But perfectionism, it is something that is so pervasive in the legal profession by design, because the legal profession, I think even more so than other high achieving professions, is one that really glorifies and rewards and requires perfectionism. But I truly believe, and now this is based on my own experience and the research, that it's also one of the biggest issues that is standing in the way of the mental health and the well-being of lawyers and law students, and also their performance. And this is something that I actually found myself once I had already started my career in lawyer well-being. And just, I mean, a teeny short backstory. I initially, when I was in law school and starting out in practice, I wore my perfectionism like a badge of honor. I thought that it was the thing that was driving my success. At that point, I was a raging overachiever, just kind of constantly chasing gold stars, and I was really good at collecting them and moving on to the next thing. But I eventually reached a breaking point, which was how I initially discovered positive psychology in the first place. And that was what sparked my interest in changing my career towards teaching lawyer well-being. And I made a lot of changes in my life based on positive psychology, transferred over to teaching well-being to lawyers working at a law school. I thought my problems were solved. Fast forward a few months, working in this new job that is aligned with my values and all of these other things that positive psychology would say should be solving my problems. And I burned out again. And it was at that point that I realized that you can take the lawyer out of the toxic environment, but if you don't take the toxicity out of the lawyer, they're not going to be well. They're not going to be happy. And what I realized was that even though I was working in a different context that was aligned with my values, I was still operating from this ruthlessly perfectionist mindset and this perceived unworthiness where I was hustling to prove my worth and using shame and self-criticism to try to drive myself forward. And I ultimately realized that if I didn't address that, I could make all these other changes, but I'd still be tearing myself down from the inside out. And so it was there that I recognized for myself that perfectionism is a necessary starting place, really, for so many lawyers and law students' efforts to enhance their own well-being. And that has informed what I've done with my coaching, with my speaking and training, and now is really, I would say, the topic and the sub area of well-being that I'm most passionate about.
Well, I think it's an interesting discussion because, as people know who visited my website and heard me present Myself, I was a trialer for 33 years and have lived with depression for the last 20 something years. And I think of myself as a recovering perfectionist. And I could see how it related not only to my stress and anxiety level, but also my depression. What do you think about that? The correlation between perfectionism and something like not just stress, but clinical anxiety and depression.
Absolutely. I mean, well, first of all, the research shows that they are so closely correlated. The both anxiety, depression, eating disorders, sexual dysfunction, chronic pain, migraines, the list goes on. And by the way, chronic pain is something that I struggled with debilitating levels for multiple years, and no traditional medicine could touch it, could fix it. It was only when I started doing mind-body medicine, which focused actually on a lot of coaching techniques that are the same things that are focused on perfectionism, that I started noticing some effects. So the research is really clear, but just going back to from thinking it through the relationship between perfectionism and depression, when we think about, I mean, maybe it's helpful to take a step back and really clarify what it is that I'm referring to when I say perfectionism, because I think that a big problem is that when people hear perfectionism, they think, well, oh, that's a good thing. That's drive. That's commitment to excellence. That's meticulous attention to detail. All of these positive qualities that I want to keep. Why would I want to get rid of my perfectionism? And the truth is that each of those qualities are distinct from perfectionism, and that we actually can hold on to those things while getting rid of the negative effects of our perfectionism. And where perfectionism differs from high standards or commitment to excellence is that there's a couple of things that make it different. So one is what's driving it. So when you have a commitment to excellence, there's some sort of purpose or passion or some positive energy that's driving you towards some outcome that you want, because it actually there will be some intrinsic validation in getting it. Perfectionism is different. Perfectionism is driven by fear, and there's different types of fear, which we can talk about later, but the most basic foundational fear is just the fear of not being good enough, of not being worthy, the fear of rejection and disappointment, and or of being a disappointment and therefore being rejected. And that drives us in a completely different way. So we are not, someone with high standards who really cares about an outcome, they're playing to win. They're playing to get this thing that they want that'll really validate them. Perfectionists aren't doing that. We're playing not to lose. We're playing to try to avoid those feelings of rejection or not being good enough, because the problem is every time that we get something that we want, every time that we quote unquote perfect something, we don't sit there and actually, delight in the pride of having or the satisfaction of having accomplished it. We're immediately setting our sights higher and moving on to the next thing that we need to perfect, or picking apart our performance. So that's one thing. And then one other thing is how do we move ourselves towards our goals? So for perfectionists, it's a ruthlessly self-critical mindset. So we try to blame and shame ourselves into perfection or performance, whereas people who are not perfectionists can have just as high standards, but their expectations for how they get to them are realistic. So they're not, completely unrealistic. It needs to be the shortest, most direct path with no learning curves or room for error. And also, they recognize that the way to move themselves towards their goals is really to nourish and fuel themselves with positive energy, or at least neutral energy, not beating themselves up. So these are all of these hallmarks of perfectionism that make it different from high standards. Going back to the link with depression here, if we think about if we're constantly blaming and shaming ourselves, what is that? Like, listen, imagine if someone was standing next to you all day telling you you're worthless, you're stupid, you're no good. Like, you better try harder because you're no good, you're stupid. Like, what is that going to do to your emotional energy? First of all, that's what so many perfectionists are doing to themselves on an ongoing basis all day. But aside from that, if we just think back to the core underlying driver beneath this perfection, this belief that we're not good enough and we're not worthy, it causes what we do is we end up chasing external achievement after external achievement in an effort to satisfy this craving for feeling like we are enough. But because we move the goalpost the second that we get there, it leaves us on this hamster wheel of ceaseless striving. But also we can become so detached from our identity. So our identity comes to depend on our ability to keep achieving things, but by trying to perfect and continue to achieve in this way, what happens to a lot of people is that we end up squeezing out every other area of our life that would actually provide a sense of intrinsic validation. So all of the things that we know are essential for mental health and resilience, and what helps counter depression, emotional connection, exercise, like meaning and purpose and all of that, there's no space for that when we're on the perfectionist hamster wheel. And so it's not at all surprising that the two go hand in hand.
Well, let's take another step back. And I've often wondered about this, and I've been asked about this. I teach a law school class like you do on mental health. And I often am asked, you know, does being a lawyer cause depression or cause anxiety? And, you know, I often think to myself, you know, even before we step foot in law school, we have certain risk factors. Some people are already anxious or depressed, or some people enter, but they're not, but develop it in law school or graduate from law school and develop it as lawyers. So I'm interested in what you think about where does it come from? And how does that play out as in law school and as lawyers?
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. I think the only study that I've seen on it is Andy Benjamin's study from the 90s that suggests that it's not that lawyers are just predisposed, because what his study shows is that law students come in with completely average rates of mental health challenges, but that we see that the rates of anxiety and substance use and depression markedly increase during the 1L year and then continue to increase. So that would suggest that something is happening in law school. I think it's definitely something's happening in law school in the legal profession that exacerbates this and causes it, triggers it from a number of people. I mean, all of the things that contribute to this, right? So the training in issue spotting that intensifies our negativity bias, if we're constantly taught to look only for problems and mistakes and spot every issue, that's how we're going to look at ourselves too. And all humans have that evolutionary predisposition, but it just becomes amplified in lawyers. I think also the adversarial nature of the profession, the curve, disastrous for social connection and trust and belonging, which we know is essential. And then, of course, you know, there's the billable hour model for those that it applies to, the intense time pressures, and also the pressures and the lack of psychological safety around making a mistake. And because there's that threat that if you make one single mistake, like we could lose our case, like there's no room for mistakes. There's a very fixed mindset mentality that's embedded into the profession that I think exacerbates mental health challenges and also exacerbates perfectionism. That being said, Larry Richards' research on the lawyer personality suggests that lawyers are predisposed to personality traits that might make them more susceptible to anxiety and depression. So low sociability, high urgency, high autonomy, and perfectionism, I think, whether or not we're born, I think type A mentalities often go to law school. I mean, that was why I went to law school. I was like, I don't know what I want to do. Practicing psychology or teaching, which were the things that I was most intrinsically called to, didn't feel prestigious enough to me. So I was like, oh, well, I'm so type A and I'm pretty good at taking tests. I should go to law school. That was honestly the amount of reasoning that went into it, which are, of course, terrible reasons to go to law school. But I think that often people are like, oh, well, you're very type A and meticulous. You would be a great lawyer. And I think that those traits can make people especially susceptible to these things, and then law school intensifies them. And then by the time we're out of law school, we're already predisposed, but we're also walking into a profession that fosters them even more. And so it's kind of, I think there needs to be interventions at every single level. I think there needs to be systemic changes at the law, at the legal employer level, at the law school level, and then also for all of the individuals themselves too, because as my experience shows, while the structural and systemic issues are hugely important, there's a lot of individual stuff that we need to address too, if we really want to, you know, make comprehensive change and support for people.
Yeah, I think those are great observations. And it's just not a question of an individual working on themselves on these issues, but also collectively as a workplace culture, law school culture. I want to make sure we leave enough time, and I think we have plenty of time, but you know, to have a robust discussion about some solutions. And I asked you in our email exchange preparing for today, you know, would the solutions that might work for law students be the same as for lawyers with, you know, perfectionism, whoever perfectionism problem, or would they be the same? Would they be different? What do you think about that, Jordana?
Yeah, and we're talking right now about an individual level.
Yes.
Yeah. Correct.
Let's talk about individual first, and then we could go out to 30,000 feet and talk about the workplace culture in law school.
Absolutely. So I think that they would be the same approach and the same strategies for lawyers and law students alike, because the context will change. Certainly, you know, how does your perfectionism manifest amidst the challenges and the stresses of your life as a lawyer or a law student? But I think just going back to how I defined perfectionism, of that being driven by that underlying fear, the fear of failure or the fear of not being worthy, and the self-critical approach to motivation, though, that I really think is at the core of it for all perfectionists. And I think the antidotes to that are the same for all members of all groups. And really, I think the two most important things, one is values, identification, and alignment. So getting clear on what actually matters to you, what do you really care about? Because for a lot of perfectionists, not all, but many, and certainly this was my case, my whole metric for what mattered and what was important was based on impressing others and achieving and trying to demonstrate my worth. And that going back to the playing not to lose rather than playing to win, if you want to play to win, you have to figure out what it actually means to win for you, because that external validation is never actually going to provide you with that sense of internal validation that you so desperately crave. And so figuring out what your values are and how you can honor them rather than just listening to your fear, that's one step. The other thing, which I think is honestly the most potent strategy for addressing perfectionism, but also well-being and performance more generally, is cultivating self-compassion. And that is something that whenever I bring up that word, most lawyers will run in the other direction, because they're like, that sounds terrible. It's going to make me weak and lazy and complacent and lose my edge. And it sounds intuitive, right? But the science on this, and Dr. Kristin Neff is really the leading expert in this area, shows that it's truly like treating ourselves with self-compassion in the face of mistakes or setbacks or perceived inadequacy is the most powerful thing that we can do in order to enhance our performance and our achievement, as well as our well-being. And so this ruthless self-criticism that so many of us believe is necessary to drive us forward, it's actually been holding us back this whole time. We just like cannot see it. And if we can learn to relate to ourselves in this different way, which takes a lot of work, because this self-critical voice is so deeply ingrained and programmed into us, If we can learn to change that dynamic, it will actually turbocharge our motivation and our learning and our performance. And I truly believe, and the research shows, and as does my personal experience, and I've seen it countless times with my students and clients, this self-compassion piece is the most, it's necessary, the most necessary thing for really making a meaningful progress on the perfectionism.
I want to get your thoughts about this because I know you're an expert and have training in the area of positive psychology, and you know very well about Dr. Martin Seligman from the University of Pennsylvania. He had a great chapter in one of his books called Why Are Lawyers So Unhappy? And he talks about the contrast between optimism and pessimism, which I found fascinating, and that how lawyers tend to be pessimistic. And how they look at the world and how they look at life and how they live their work days, their careers. And he said something very interesting, which I thought was right on point. He says, you know, if you don't know how to think like that, where you're looking for trouble, you're looking for problems, I was always hyper vigilant as a lawyer looking for problems. If you don't know how to do that, law school will teach that to you. And while it may be an adaptive or something that in a some way you do as a lawyer. He also said that this is pretty devastating at the end. It doesn't make you a very happy human being. And what do you think about that, especially that, you know, this optimism, pessimism, and really, you know, what we're talking about today, perfectionism.
So I think it's great, and I love that chapter, and I love the book that it comes from. It's called L Learned Optimism, because what he's promoting is not, so first the word learned. So he's saying that lawyers aren't screwed. We can learn this, but what he suggests is that lawyers learn flexible optimism. So he's not saying that lawyers should just become eternal optimists in every sphere of life, including in when they're looking at their clients' matters, because that would impair our ability to safeguard our clients' interests quite potentially. But what he's saying is that we can learn this other way of thinking. And what that does is it empowers us to then choose. So you can think about it as having your rose-colored glasses and your doom-colored glasses, and you can change your sunglasses to suit the weather. And so you can put on your hyper problem spotting, issue spotting, rooting out every possible flaw when you're looking at some document in your case, or when you're looking at the facts of a case before you. But when you're looking at yourself or your performance on something, you can recognize, like, hey, it's actually not going to be constructive for me to be tearing myself apart like that. And I can view this through this other lens. And so, interestingly, just for anyone who's listening, it's not familiar with Seligman's work, his distinction between optimism and pessimism, it's not just like glass half empty, glass half full. And optimism isn't like this Pollyanna viewpoint. It's actually, so a pessimistic approach, he says, when we look at negative things, we perceive them as being personal, permanent, and pervasive. So something goes wrong and we say, it's all my fault. It's going to be permanent. It's going to be terrible forever. And it's pervasive. It's going to be terrible. It's like everything is going to be terrible for me.
Catastrophe.
Whereas, total catastrophe, catastrophizing, personalizing, black and white thinking, all of these thinking traps that are really pervasive among perfectionists. Whereas someone who is an optimistic thinker could see the same thing that goes wrong. We're not delusional. We don't say, oh, well, this is great, even though something went wrong. But we look at them rather than personal, pervasive, and permanent. It's temporary, local, and specific, and within our control. So this is this bad thing that can happen. It happened here, but it's specific to this occasion. Let me look at the external factors that contributed to this rather than just assuming that I'm terrible and worthless, because what good is that? And what can I do to actually fix it? And so, interestingly, this optimistic approach actually positions us for growth. Whereas the pessimistic approach, it's kind of like why self-criticism isn't helpful, because if we're just kind of screaming on ourselves on the inside or chastising ourselves with, you're bad, you're worthless, what's wrong with you? How is that helping us figure out how to do better next time? It's not. All it's doing is making us feel terrible, deflating our confidence, and actually distracting us from identifying ways that we can improve. And so just going back to the Seligman, what he shows is that lawyers have this predisposition to be thinking in these pessimistic ways. And the reason that we have this predisposition is because that's how we're trained to think in law school. And so something called neuroplasticity is that when we think in a specific way, same as if we behave in a specific way, the neurons that fire when we think in that way, the neural connections actually become stronger, making it much easier and more instinctive for us to think in that way. So when we practice issue spotting, we get really good at issue spotting, and ultimately we spot issues everywhere we look. But what Seligman has shown is that we can rewire our brains to build the opposing muscle of looking for positive things and of thinking in this more optimistic framework. And this is why if we practice self-compassionate thoughts, or if we practice optimistic thoughts, even though we don't believe them and we won't believe them at first, the neural connections that facilitate those thoughts will actually grow stronger, which means that over time it'll be easier for us to think in that way when we want to. And then you might think, well, why would I want to think in that way? When isn't that just being delusional or ignoring reality? And the truth is, our instinctive negative thoughts, just because they're instinctive, it doesn't mean that they're reality. So, and the example is, Dan, you might write, let's say you write a blog post, and then afterwards your inner critic perfectionist is tearing you up saying, that was a stupid blog post, Dan, you're so terrible. Why are you so terrible? Why can everyone write but you? You're having those thoughts, you truly believe them. Does that make them true? Well, as your friend who, you know, deeply admires you and the things you write, I can go vouch on 99% certainty without having read whatever blog post you're tearing yourself up about that it's not actually true. So our brain sends us tons of thoughts that aren't necessarily true. And often for perfectionists, they're rooted in this very deeply ingrained pattern of negative self-talk that our brains think are protecting us from danger, but they're not, and they're not rational, and they're not constructive. And the truth is that all the science shows that these self-critical thoughts are actually self-defeating, because they're destroying our mental health and well-being, and they're also actually impeding our performance. And so if we can teach ourselves to think in ways that not only make us feel better, but the research shows will actually enable us to perform better, who cares if they're objective reality? There is no objective reality. Like, let's do it.
You know, I was going to, and we have about 5 minutes or so left, and I think this is an important point. You know, you and I in our work as lawyers, as wellness advocates, you as a coach, the both of us as law professors, I'm often asked, you know, okay, people say, okay, I get what it might be like to go to a therapist, a psychologist, a psychotherapist, and, you know, get some kind of counseling as it relates to maybe being a perfectionist, being anxious or depressed. Yeah. But how would a coach approach that issue? So you as a coach, are there things that you would do separate, differently from a therapist, or in some ways they're the same? Can they work together?
Yes, absolutely. So I am, as someone with an excellent therapist and an excellent coach, I am firmly of the mindset that most people could benefit from both, because they do operate very differently, though they can be really mutually reinforcing. And so the kind of most basic distinction between therapy and coaching is that therapy is really focused on diagnosing and understanding the origins of and treating mental health challenges. So for a perfectionist, you might say, like, oh, well, you're struggling with perfectionism. Maybe you're probably struggling with depression or anxiety or one of the many other things that goes alongside it. Where did this perfectionism come from? And so for me in particular, something that I figured out from my therapist is, One, I think a lot of messages that were delivered to me growing up, my inner critic stems a lot from messages that I either directly received or indirectly received from my parents. Also, my perfectionism really took root at a point when there were some really scary, uncontrollable things going on in my family. And perfectionism, another hallmark of perfectionism, is this unrealistic desire to maintain control over everything. And so looking back, putting the pieces together with a therapist, I could say, oh, my perfectionist really took root when it felt like my world was spiraling out of control. And this was my way to try to regain control. So that can help you understand where it came from. Where coaching really comes in is, how are you going to move forward? And how are we going to help you move forward? So what strategies, what action steps can you deploy to move forward? In order to do that, we want to identify what's standing in your way between what you want. And often it's a combination of practical external obstacles that you can strategize about how to circumvent and overcome them. But a lot of it are these limiting beliefs that we have. And so this is that self-critical, self-doubt, self-shame mindset that is preventing you from taking action in a way that you want to, that would enhance your well-being and your performance, that would be counter to these perfectionist impulses. Because really what perfectionism is, it's anxious impulses that we effectively become a slave to. And it's ironic because we want control, but then we become totally controlled by our perfectionism. And so as a coach, what I can help perfectionists do is develop a plan for first figuring out, like, what is their definition of big picture perfection? So recognizing, like, you can't perfect every single thing that you want to, but what are your values? What do you care about most? And looking at the big picture of your life and your work, what's most important to you, and how can you optimize those things without just kind of acting on this perfectionist autopilot where you're not actually getting the results that are satisfying or sustainable for you. Also, looking at these deep-seated beliefs about, in the self-critical voice, I mean, so many perfectionists, we have this self-critical internal dialogue going on with ourselves all day, and we don't even realize it, much less have any idea that we could, how we could disarm our inner critics so that they're not so loud and powerful and compelling us to act at their behest throughout our days. And so a lot of the work is familiarizing yourself and disentangling yourself from your inner critic and empowering yourself to see it, but move beyond it and cultivate a more empowering voice that will enable you to prevent overwhelm, prevent exhaustion, and actually live a life that's honored, that's driven by your values rather than just your fear. A lot of practical things in terms of time management, project management. I mean, it's ironic, perfectionists are actually horrible with time management because often they let perfection be the enemy of the good. And a lot of things end up not happening because they're so determined to keep perfecting certain things that may not be the most essential thing. So there's a lot of work that goes into, you've identified this thing that's hurting you. How can we help you break free from it and increase your well-being, increase your performance, and really level up your confidence and step into your power so your inner critic isn't forever calling the shots?
Yeah, well, that's fascinating. And I can see, and I'm a big advocate for therapy and coaching as a great adjunct to one another. And I have done both at the same time. And I think that I've often said, or I've said to you privately, what a great big light you are in the world. And you're the rare combination of intelligence, you know, great insights and a kind heart. And I think, you know, your gift is desperately needed in our profession. And I just think that it's so helpful to unpack these issues and talk about them in an intelligent way so that we can make sense of our lives as lawyers and those in the legal profession, including law students. So I just want to really thank you for your time, Jordana, today, And as always, every time we talk, I not only enjoy our talks, but I learn a lot. So thank you.
Oh, Dan, thank you so much. That is so sweet. And I just want to say for anyone listening, like we all have our gifts and we all have our light within us. And I think the saddest thing is that for so many perfectionists, they actually, and this was true of me for the longest time, they dim their lights and they ignore their gifts because they're so hard trying to perfect themselves into who that they think that they should be and need to be. And it is only when they do the really hard and scary but doable work of moving through that fear and that they can really step into who they are and, you know, make the greatest possible impact and shine in a way that they have no clue they could, if they gave themselves a chance. So thank you so much for inviting me to have this discussion today. It's such a pleasure and special treat getting to spend this time with you.
Okay, thank you, Jordana. And join us next time for another great interview with people involved in the wellness and well-being and mental health fields. And that's it for now.